an honor to have him here in Black Mountain. I'm glad you're here to share the experience with me anyway. So help me welcome Leo Kaki.
Is there a, is that thing still open back there? That? Thanks for coming. It's nice to be back here. There's a tune, got that out of the way. There's a tune a few years ago called Betty Davis Eyes. This is called Neil Young Hair. Try and get my tempo in line here. Thank you. Crowd pleasers in my repertoire. I can't get enough of that thing. It's my own fault. I recorded this first of all, I've had two sort of themes with my relations with the labels that I've worked for. I'm with my third label and my seventh record for them. It's one more than I've made for anybody else. But every one of these people, the first one being Capitol, where to John Fahey took me after I made a record for him, which said to me, which being the A&R department, they called me up one day. This happens early on with every label, and then seasonally thereafter, they called me up and said, you know, Leo, we had a meeting and what you need is a, and I'm quoting them now, and I like these people. I mean, they let me record and they pay me to do it, and you know, what more do you want? But they had a meeting and they call me up and they tell me that what I need is a chick singer. And if I had a chick singer, they could get it on the radio and, you know, we'd all make money. I've fogged that more or less successfully so far. The other one is we've had a meeting, and you know what? We could sell like razor blades, and we all want to make money. We know you want to make money, and you know we want to make money is a Christmas album. If you'd make a Christmas album for us. And if you tell them, you know, hasn't that been done? They say, not by you, and you groan, and they laugh, and... And I have said that I'm pretty sure of this, that part of the reason people still come to hear me play is that I haven't made a Christmas album. I think it's disgusting myself. I mean, yeah, let's revolt. Recently fired. The label is really BMG, which is, I don't know what BMG is, but they own me and everything else on earth, including RCA, which used to own everything else on earth, but now it's BMG, which is some mysterious family as far as I've been able to determine, somewhere in Germany. Fortunately, I haven't heard them yet aligned with what is that? Torn and Traxxas? Praxis? Torn and... Anybody know that family? No. Some obscure knot of plutocrats in Bavaria somewhere. What do they do all day long, you know? But we'll save that for the revolt. Torn und Praxis. That's it, isn't it? They have a queen or a something. So they fired the label at any rate. The surrogate of Torn und Praxis fired the label, and the name remains, I remain, but the label itself is entirely new, and I got a call from the new A&R department. Leo, we're going to put out a Christmas album. You know, and I made my usual complaints and pointed out the usual blah, blah, blah. And they said, well, it's, you know, it's just, it's not all you. It's just one, all we want is just one cut. You know, that'd be, it's me something on there from Liberace, the Hansons. We're trying to think, you know, who do we need to fill this out? This will sell like razor blades. And I said, no, I can't. And they talked me into it because they're new and they run my career. And because they otherwise let me do anything I want to do on a record. So I said, all right, but I can't do Silent Night. I've tried, and I don't even want to try any of the others. And where's that lead? I said, why don't I write one? Why don't I write a Christmas song? And they said, well, and they hung up. And and I heard from them a couple days later, and they had a meeting and decided that would be fine. And so I wrote this, but I sort of by way of defense and condemnation of myself, I realized, waiting for their return call, that I had a fragment laying around that I could just put a Christmassy sort of title on, and that'd be the end of it. I wouldn't have to really bust my brain or anything. You know, go on through, you know, that deep philosophical questioning of, you know, the nature of Christmas. And how would you, is that all whole notes? Can you have a couple quarter notes in it? Is it all coda? Is it all, and a lot of that. And so I just dragged this out, but here's the thing. It was a fragment because it wouldn't finish. I couldn't finish the thing. And as soon as I knew that it was a Christmas song, I could finish it. So, and I swear to you, this sounds like Christmas to me. And it's not all whole notes. It's called Accordion Bells. Thank you. of a Darth Vader Christmas. Stereo first made its way into the concert sound business. One of the first companies to have a stereo system, I think it was Tycho Brahe, might have been Shoko. There's some great companies, Dinky Dawson. Dinky was the best. He and his theories were what wound up being embodied in the Grateful Dead's sound system. Which means absolutely nothing. But it's the stuff, you know, I spend a lot of time by myself and I think about these things. Anyhow, the company brought out the new stereo system to Neil's place in Northern California at the time to demonstrate it for him because they wanted it, of course, to go on tour with him. So they had to approximate kind of your shed stadium deal, they put the left side in front of his house and the right side in front of his barn, and they put Neil in the pond out there in a boat. And he was sitting out there in the boat, and they played some music for him, and he started making, you know, waves, and they turned it off and said, "What?" And he said, "More barn." I love that. Obviously. Friends of theirs. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Which is what the chorus should have been, because the wedding ended in a divorce 3 years later. And this guy, you'll hear Tony and Mario mention it here, that's the restaurant that he used to hang out in and mope when she wasn't around. Says, "Baby, what you doing? I've been wondering where you've been. Now and then I think about you and me. No use fighting about things we can't recall, 'cause it don't matter now at all. Just come on in, baby, we'll laugh and sing and we'll make love. Let the telephone ring, ring, doorbell ring, come on in, I got Mel Blanc on the radio. I'm glad you came around, I've been feeling down, talking to Tony and Mario. You know they make good conversation, still it ain't no consolation, 'cause I got love, baby I'll give you some. Somebody comes, let the doorbell ring." sun around your pretty finger. Ring, ring, voices ring with a happy tune. Anybody can be a singer. The sun comes up across the city, and I swear you never looked so young and pretty. Hand in hand we'll stand upon the sand. Preacher band, let the wedding bells ring. Hand in hand we'll stand upon the sand. Preacher band, let the wedding bells ring. A tune that, I've been trying to write for a long time, and I think this actually happens, was itself trying to happen. You can kind of feel an itch, and after a while it identifies itself as a some kind of tune or something, but that's enough of that. The reason this happened was because of a story that I was told by a friend of mine named Seika Tavjar, who's a lithographer from Ljubljana, which is a city in Slovenia, which is easier to say than its capital, which is northwestern Yugoslavia, whatever that place is now. I'm calling it Yugoslavia. And I used to tour there all the time. I'd go there and milk it for all I could and then run away. And I did that every year for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. And went there the first time with a truly great musician named Paco de la Silla. We'd been doing this double bill through the rest of Europe and finished there in Yugoslavia. And that was when I met Seika. We were at a party after the show, a forced party. The party was still running things there, and they were under some kind of constraint to demonstrate the successes of their system, which meant dragging out, against their will, all of the local luminaries to parade before, as far as I could tell, before us. And I still don't, I never will understand. And we played the show and went to this dinner afterwards and got drunk because I still drank then, and nobody wanted to be there. And the people who made dinner for us were not told that they were making dinner for us until we showed up at their house. This was a house. At like, 1 in the morning. I don't know when we should. 12 people who dragged them out of bed, and these guys in leather coats that make food. And I was sitting next to Seika. There was a heart surgeon and a bunch of, I don't know, a physicist, that kind of trip. And I was sitting next to the token artist of the system who at that moment happened to be Seika Tavchar. And I asked her what she did. She said, I'm a lithographer. And as I've said before, I said, oh, a lithographer from Ljubljana, because I'd been drinking. And she, of course, didn't smile, and I got very angry with her for that, because I'd been drinking. And after a while, I said, well, can I see some of your lithographs? And she said, no. But after a while, she's in this silence, you know, because by now, if it wasn't clear what kind of night Paco and I were in for, well, it was clear. And so I just returned to my Slivovitz. And after a while, she said, well, you could see some, because she'd been drinking also. You could see some if I had any, but I had a show in Paris 2 years earlier, and I sold all 10 of my lithographs. I didn't understand, and I said, what do you mean? How can that be? I thought you run 10. You must have. No, I have none. No. Anyhow, the trip was for her. She runs one litho, you know, goes to all of the labor and inspiration of carving this stone or etching it or whatever you call it, but you do it on the stone. And then you run 500 lithos from that stone, but not Seika. Seika, she insists, runs one litho and then destroys the stone. She breaks the stone is the word verb she used. So I understood that I was talking to a lunatic lithographer from Ljubljana. She was nuts. I mentioned last night, that's like, you know, having dinner and blowing up the house you had it in. It's a perfectly empty gesture, you know. So I forgot about the whole thing, and I left the country, but the tour was a success, and I came back every year. Seika showed up every year. And 1 year she said, I can't hang around. My father just found his way home. I'm taking care of him. She left. I left. The next year I came back. She showed up again in the green room in this beautiful hall in Ljubljana, and I said, how's your dad? Picking up the conversation where we'd left off a year earlier. And she said, he's dead. I thought, oh, it's going to be another one of those nights. And if you like, she said, I'll come by the hotel tomorrow and show you the things that he's done here. And I wasn't sure. I wanted to see what he had done. And but he'd been an architect and an engineer, and while admiring a bridge that he had built, she told me he'd been arrested when she was 3 years old. And I said, what did he do? Which pissed her off. She said, he didn't do anything. You don't have to do anything. He was just arrested, that's all. We weren't told why he was arrested. We weren't told where he was being kept, and we weren't told how long he would be kept. And when he got home last year, they let him out because he was dying, and he'd been in prison for 26 years. And she told me this whole story. They'd gotten two letters in the course of his imprisonment, the first one like 12 years into it, with nothing, no word. And they naturally had written him off, telling them that he was alive. The second letter came another like 12 years, telling them he was still alive. Now this whole time, Seika lived in the same, and at the time she was telling me this, lived in the same apartment house from like 2 till 29. And when this guy got out, that's when she and her older sister and her mother found out that he'd been imprisoned across the street from that apartment house. And he was in a basement cell, and he could look up every night through a slit window that he had and see Seika and her older sister playing on the balcony, and he watched them grow up from down there. It was too grim to remember, and so I forgot it. I'm certain that's why she breaks the stone. I have one of her lithographs now. I can't find her. I don't know what's happened to her or her son. And this turned up when I remembered that story all at once one day. It's called Across the Street. Just something to take all the steam out of the set. There's a little suicide room over to the side there. You can. There's a rope. Rusty gun. Arthur Rubinstein tried to kill himself in Berlin in the, I think it was in the 20s, might have been in the teens, probably was the teens. He obviously failed. He was like 20 at the time and was disgusted with himself because he was doing all of these Chopin concerts and didn't know the music. He was faking it, and which is pretty incredible, but he was faking it and getting away with it. The critics loved him, but he was overwhelmed, obviously, with disgust and self-loathing, so he went in his closet and hung himself with a necktie, and the necktie broke. And he claims that he started laughing then, and just wait for the change, and we'll be back together, and it can't be the same. Thank you. great. My favorite thing. These migrate, you know, they just... That's why orchestra players carry their violins and so forth around with, like this. They're always holding the strings because it keeps them warm. They stay in tune. Which leaves some of the instruments out in the cold, I think. God darn. This is a tune that I found myself trying to do one day on a radio show, and I didn't know the lyrics, which, you know, incisive mind that I have told me that I had better find some lyrics. And I called the only guy I know who would... It seems a little
up
here now. Who would... Wow. Who would know what these were. He's a retired exopaleo-organic geochemist. Isn't that something? He spent, what, 50 years in universities getting that job description, and it's a job that you is not going to exist for probably another 200 years, where you examine the fossil evidence of life on other planets. As a result, he was one of the first three people to look at the moon rocks that came back, and was so disgusted by what followed after that he decided to collect a copy of every record ever made. I don't know what the connection is, but he made it. And he has a foundation, and I'm on his board of directors. And this is done by the Delmore brothers, and he asked me to please sing it the way it was originally written, which is not Deep River Blues, but Big River Blues. I find that almost impossible, but I'll try. Let it rain. Let the rain drive right on, let the waves sweep along, 'cause I got those big river blues. She looks like a waterfowl when I got those big river blues. I got no one to cry for me. The fish all go out on a spree when I got those big river blues. boat, 'cause I got those big river blues. I'm going back to Muscle Shoals, times are better there, I'm told, 'cause I got those big river blues. 'Cause I got those big river blues. Heard Mick E. Clark do this tune in Detroit right after it burned down. Everybody thought it kind of sad when they found Louise in a row, and they'd always put her down below their kind. Since I'm crying. Thank you. Required to take a short break during which you can rush the bar and whatever you want to do. But please come back. That's the important thing. About 15 minutes. Thank you. Thank you. John Hurt do this tune, Bob Dylan and Furry Lewis. Everybody has their own take on this thing, and Furry had a very upbeat version of the thing, and turned the guitar over while he was playing and started drumming along, and it was an electric guitar, so that the effect on the audience was not, you know, salubrious. It got kind of stiff out there. And when he was done, he flipped the guitar back up and the pickups fell out, so that now nothing was happening except for Furry, who was having the time of his life. So ever since seeing that, I'd try not to have too good a time up there. Corey Nicole. so long. I've been worried about you ever since you've been gone. I've got a bird that whistles. I've got a bird that sings. I've got a bird that whistles. A bird that sings. But if I ain't got call, since you've been gone. I stuck this thing in my mouth the other night to hold on to it while I was switching guitars. Nothing happened, but, you know, I suppose something could, you know? I don't know. It's, what is that, DC? It's like putting a telephone in your bathtub. Nothing would happen. But I, no, that's true. It's a direct current on a telephone, and it's a real low... Right? Isn't there any... Well, it is. I do all my interviews from a bathtub, so please don't tell me otherwise. I know the guy. He's a friend of mine who presided over the first rock and roll electrocution. He was a Welshman named Rob, and he did sound for me for about 8 consecutive tours in Europe. He did the tour that I did with Paco de Lucia. But it was was his sound system the night that this band called Stone the Crows went on stage. Rob was back there at the desk. And the guitar player who fronted the group came up to the mic and said, people jumped to their feet. He said, are you ready to And then, he closed the ground between him and the microphone. And you'll see that, you know, every now and then you'll see a spark hit somebody. But and they react much worse than, I mean, it just, you know, for a second you think you've had it. In this case, and if you've had that second to think that you've had it, you, of course, are not going to suffer. It just hurts a little. In this guy's case, he had it. And the people were all on their feet. Rob couldn't see what had happened. And he finally made his way through the crowd. There was a stiff on the stage. You know, and if you want to, as he did, have a career in sound reinforcement, and you kill people when you do it, you're starting at, you know, at a negative, sort of a minus position. But he overcame and got me, among other people. Rob was in a cover band. He was in a cover band. He and four other kids. Rob was the oldest in the band. He was either 14 or 13. He was young. The others were even younger, and they were covering the Jackson 5. This was a Welsh Jackson 5 cover band. And they all had these white jumpsuits and everything, and they, you know, do these moves. That's one of them. Do these moves. And all over Wales. They were a big hit in Wales. And they'd go onto these stages, and a little curtain would go up, or, you know, some production would happen. And every night started with Rob on the Hammond organ, and he'd hit this note, you know, his hand in the air. The tension is building, and then he would count, one, two, three, plum, you know, and the Jackson 5 cover band of Wales would pounce on whatever, you know, some hit, and the crowd of Welshmen would go wild. And but Rob, as you may have already noticed, didn't have good luck with stages and stuff, and they were playing somewhere one night, Aberfan, or, you know, one of those. And Rob hit his note. But earlier that day, Rob, for the first time and possibly the last time in his life, had taken LSD. This was Welsh Owsley or something. It had that effect, and he hit his note, and he couldn't let go of the note. Couldn't count, couldn't let go of the note. The Jackson 5 Welsh cover band just stood there for what I'm sure seemed like an eternity to Rob. Had no end. And I shouldn't tell you this. This is so grim. But if you do, you know, if you can imagine. I mean, this is really funny to me, but it's not funny at all. I think most people who play would think this was really funny, but obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, for obvious reasons. But I shouldn't tell you this, and I'm going to. I prevented myself from saying it last night, wherever I was. But this is an amazing thing. I mentioned Aberfan, and Rob and the Welsh cover band of the Jackson 5 was booked in to Aberfan one year, and they went there, and they hit the note, the curtain went up, and Rob did the count. Before the count, rather, holding the note, the audience burst into tears. A whole room full of people just cried. You know, and for a second, I suppose they thought, man, are we getting over? And then, no, we're not getting over. Imagine that. I mean, that's the funny part. You walk on, are you ready to rock? And they all cry. What have you done wrong? Well, this is awful. This is the awful part. Maybe I shouldn't even tell you the awful part. Oh, I know you're going to hate me for this. The Aberfan had a school. Every kid in town went to this, the same school, 210 kids, I think, 220. The school was next to a slag heap. It was a mining town. And one day, the slag heap collapsed on the school and killed every child in the village of Aberfan. The next child or version of a child that this village saw was the Welsh cover band. And when the curtain went up and they saw these, I was sitting around once with three other guitarists talking about the worst job we'd ever had. And I forgot all about Rob's job in Aberfan. Joe Pass, his worst job was playing in Fort Worth three times a week in an insane asylum. Joe was imprisoned down the street, and part of his therapy and theirs was that he would play for them. And there was one guy whose job was to be still. That was his groove. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to move, not even a twitch. But when Joe came, he'd start to play, and this guy would walk up and just detune him. So the therapy was working for that guy. Thank you. This is a tune. We were talking about this a minute ago. That sucks on tape. I really like this tune. I think it's a great little tune. But on tape, it's just an embarrassment. Or it would be on the new record. In the real live, it seems to work fine. To be true for Ethel Merman as well. Don't you think? God. I wrote this in Australia where I would never want to live, but I love going there. I've been going there since 76. They have something like 27 or 22 versions of lethal spiders. And these are not spiders out, you know, under a rock 50 miles from nowhere. These are spiders downtown Sydney. There are a lot of them are just anywhere. Funnel spiders, they're the ones. Because they jump out at you from this. You know, there's this little funnel somewhere. You don't see it, and bang, and you're dead within a very short time. You know, when I was, you know, was a child, we had bomb alerts, and in Oklahoma, we had tornado movies. But there, they have, you know, spider shows, and it's like, you know, on your way home today, kids. Watch out for these 22 versions of lethal arachnids. And we'll get into the snakes tomorrow. I was talking to Ricky Lee Jones once about something or other, and when we were making a record, and she confessed to me that she'd always been afraid of sharks. And she grew up in Arizona. Didn't stop her, you know. Go around worrying about these sharks. I was afraid of quicksand, and you know, I lived in Cheyenne at the time, and my chances of quicksand were zip. I don't even know what it is, but the idea that you could just, your next step, the ground could suck you in. That still gives me the creeps. And there has to be someone around to throw you a stick or a vine. It's rough being that small. So anyhow, I wrote this in my hotel room last year while the room was flooding there in Sydney. This is a confluence of events, not the least of which was the rain that was going on. This is called Snorkel. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for coming out tonight. I enjoyed this once again. Hope I see you next. Thanks a lot. Thank you for listening. See you again. thanks. Thanks a lot. Drive safely and see you next year, I hope.